Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about the songs we love and the stories behind them. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg.
Hey, and welcome to the Songs of Note podcast. I'm really glad that you are here today. Guys, this is a good episode. I think you're going to like it. But for people who are new, this is a podcast where I talk about music, stories behind songs, bands. Honestly, I just try to talk about things that I'm passionate about and then pass it along and hope that you might find it interesting too. Because gosh, I love music and I love the thing that I love about talking about music. You know, somebody, I don't know if I've said this quote before, but what is it? Talking about music is like dancing about architecture, I think is the quote. And it can be very meta to talk about the things that you love about a song or to talk about why you love music. It's like trying to describe everything you love about the flavors in the cake. Like, it can be very weird to try to dissect it other than, you know, I just like it, right? And on one level, absolutely. On another level, what we try to do on this show is like take that apart a little bit. Okay, well, okay, we know you like it. Let's talk about all the surrounding things that might make that enjoyment even more or even deeper. And that's the thing that like really just excites me. And so as a music guy, as a music fan, I don't know if you guys are like this, but what I tend to do is I tend to go down, you know, rabbit holes of bands or, bands or artists, whatever. And the way that this one turned out, the timing of this is really cool because this was about, this episode is about Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young and their song Ohio. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about that in a second. But I really want to give a shout out because on Instagram, if you follow me at Songs of Note, I had mentioned, hey, if you will leave a review on the show, I would love to read it on the show. And this goes for future reviews. If you guys will leave a review, I would love to read it. I'm really grateful for it. It helps the show get seen by more people, and the more people that hear it, it expands a community of people talking about music and sharing what music they're liking and the whole deal. So I really appreciate it when you're able to do that. And so I'm just going to read these real quick. So this is from Jeffrey Darby about the Tom Petty interview. He says, awesome interview with Warren Zanes about Tom's life and his story. Especially love the Travel and Wilburys parts. You really do a great job, Ryan, in getting those stories out to music fans. Thanks so much. Jeff, thanks so much. Really appreciate it. Man, what a kind review. Thank you. And then there's also another one from Carrie. She says, love Otis Redding and love the song Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. Always makes me think of me and my sister sitting on the dock on the lake singing this song. You guys sound really great people. So not that you have to like my show, but I appreciate that you like the show. And thanks for taking time to leave a review. So if you want to leave a review, you can do that just by clicking on the purple name of the show. If you're viewing this on, I'm going to say what I'm using, an iPhone, and you're listening on iTunes, so it's going to be different based on your platform. But if you're on an iPhone on iTunes, you click the purple name of the show. It takes you to a list of the shows, and you scroll to the bottom, and there's a little spot that says write a review. So if you want to do that, awesome. If not, no problem. I'm glad you're here. Okay, let's talk about this episode. We are talking about Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young and the song Ohio. Okay, so the rabbit hole that I went down is in this band. So I always thought of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Our House, and Love the One You're With. And I mean, there's so many songs that I associate with them. And they're just a great band. But I didn't know the story behind the band. And this is a really cool example of learning the story behind the band and behind the songs. Actually made me appreciate the music more, because if I'm honest, if I'm talking about the sound of 70s music, a lot of times it is, it's not my favorite thing, and I appreciate parts of it, and there's things that I like about it, but like the singer-songwriter folksy 70s music, a lot of times that's not my thing. But this band I've always liked, but I didn't know enough about them. And so anyway, all that to say, I've been listening. I listen on Audible and the book that I've been listening to is by David Brown, and he's a senior writer for Rolling Stone, and he wrote this book, and it's called Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, The Wild Definitive Saga of Rock's Greatest Supergroup. And it's just fantastic. I didn't know hardly anything about this group, and I just loved the book. And for me, it made me appreciate some of those songs that, you know, I had always knew. I knew just from, you know, hearing radio through the years, but I didn't really know the stories behind them, like Woodstock and Helpless, Teach Your Children. I mean, there's so many, Our House. There's so many of those great, great songs. And so this interview, we're talking with David Brown, and he was just so kind to hop on the show and talk about the stories behind the band a little bit, but specifically Ohio, which is the one I wanted to focus on. And I realize now that I've said it that Love the One You're With was actually a Stephen Stills solo song, but the band performed it live a lot in their concert. So anyway, sidetrack. So this is the story about Ohio, what happened in the course of 9 days around that song, how the band, I don't want to tell you what, but it's a good interview. So I just really like talking to David. Let's head over to the interview now. This is David Brown. Well, hey, this is Ryan. I've got David Brown here. David, thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young.
Happy to be here, Ryan. Thanks for asking.
Man, I got to tell you, like, the timing for this is just so fun for me as a music guy, because I've been listening to your book on Audible and reached out about midway through, and you were kind enough to respond and say, hey, yeah, let's talk about it. And like, I'm just finishing the book this week, and I'm so excited to ask you some questions. And so, well, my first question, I always like hearing, you know, people who decide to write a book about a band. Like, what for you, did you have an intense love for the band, or what was the thing that sparked you saying, hey, I'm going to write about this band?
It's a good, great question. I think it's because I got into this band when I was 13 years old, way back when.
Yeah.
And, first through their music, my two older sisters, one of them had, you know, both their, you know, Deja Vu and Crosby, Stills, and Nash records, and I would borrow them. And even though they had broken up by that point, this was the mid-70s, there was an incredible mystique around those guys. You know, they were just these sort of rock gods, if you will, at the time. And so I loved those records, and I suddenly realized, oh, they have these solo albums, and I became instantly immersed in the whole family tree. And in part because the music just didn't, for me as a little kid at that point, it still sounded so different from everything else. I mean, those harmonies were things I hadn't quite heard before, and the individual personalities of each guy, that was really fascinating to me too. Like a lot of, you know, if you grew up listening to, say, the Beach Boys or the Four Seasons on the radio, no, I love those records too, but it's not like you could make out every guy's voice necessarily. Right. You know, Brian Wilson's voice would jump out or whatever, but the harmonies were very tight. And with these guys, since each of them would sing lead on their own song, I mean, and you could tell these were three or four, whoever was on the record, very distinct, different personalities, different musical backgrounds, and yet somehow it all came together. It was all fascinating to me. And so basically, I became hooked on their music and their story way back then, and just kept following it, you know, as a fan, and then eventually as a writer and journalist. As the decades went on, there were lots of highs and lows, and for them, and I saw them in concert a bunch of times, you know, as a group, as a solo artist, as duo acts, all the thing. And the story was just constantly fascinating to me. And in about 10 years ago, I published a book called Fire and Rain, which was about rock and roll in the United States and politics and everything in 1970, just focused on that year. And I got to write at length about the CSNY as part of that book, really for the first time to that degree. And so then years later, I was thinking of writing another book. We were coming up, this was 2 years ago, to the 50th anniversary of the first CSN record. And I thought, well, that's a good reason to write another book. There hadn't been that many on them, actually, either. Yeah. So that was another reason. It was like, might as well, you know, bring the story up to date and really bring my own angle and see who I could talk to and all of that. So it was a labor of love that had probably been festering in me for
that's awesome.
Decades.
I love it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you bring up the unique personalities in the group, and you know, for me, I'm a huge Beatles fan, and like so many people are, but that was something that always stuck me about the Beatles was, well, I identify with one. Like, specifically, I'm going to identify with one more than another, but I know each of their characteristics, at least as the general persona goes. And there's not a lot of bands that have that. In this band, after reading your book, I feel like I have a very clearly defined difference between these four guys. They're so different. I don't know how they ever made music, and especially after hearing all the ups and downs of it. Which, like, if you had to pick the guy that you relate to or the within the band, who would it be for you?
Boy, wow, that's a good one. I think one of the ongoing pulls of that group, the allure of them in the beginning, and I think it's something that people, their fans, still relate to as the years and decades went on, is that I think each one of them embodied a certain archetype. Mm. You know, Crosby was the sort of, you know, loudmouth, you know, stick it to the man, rebel,
yeah.
You know, live like what he had, the way on his terms and all that. You know, Stills was the super impassioned kind of careerist guy who would, you know, stay up for days in the studio to make sure the work was right, and also wrote all the heartbreak songs that a lot of people related to. Mm. You know, Nash was this very refined, even though he grew up in a working-class British family, but still kind of exuded a kind of refined, courtly guy who, you know, tended to have the most crushes from the female fans. Mm-hmm. My older sister did, so I can attest to that. and Neil was always the loner, as to paraphrase one of his own songs, you know, the guy who basically couldn't quite commit to them and just, you know, wanted to kind of be on his own path. And so I think there are things about each of those personalities that we could all relate to,
yeah,
at one point or another in our lives. You know, I think we all can relate to the drivenness of Stills or the rebellious streak of Crosby. Even if we aren't like that, you know, we might want to be one of those people at one point in our lives. And so I think that was... that was a dynamic that, other than, you say, the Beatles, we hadn't really seen in pop. And I think with me, I probably related to each one of those people at different points in my life in a similar way.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think it's shifted, you know, as I got older, and you know, Nash was the guy with the nice, you know, the beautiful, you know, Victorian house in San Francisco with the you know, the pond in the bathroom with the fresh, you know, with the goldfish in the pond in the bathroom. And, you know, as I got older, I was like, wow, it's nice to live in a place like that. Not that I have, but, you know, this is one trivial example. But, you know, it's, you know, for me, I think I just, you know, I could wanted to relate to them in different ways. And I think a lot of their fans did, too.
Mm, yeah, and that's a cool way to put it, is that you might relate to them at different points of your life. That resonates with me.
And you know, just to go back to your musical, how they came together in music, I mean, that's also fascinating, because they're all so different, you know. I mean, you know, Stills comes from a kind of folk and rock and roll thing. Nash with the Hollies, from very much a pop side, and very much a British music hall kind of side to him. You know, Crosby grew up, not even, you know, when I interviewed him for the book, he admitted he didn't really listen to, like, Elvis growing up. He loved jazz and classical music as a kid. And Neil, more of a folk blues, you know, folk and rock guy, rather, like Stills. But again, like, not four guys you'd think would ever have anything in common musically.
Right.
And yet they made it work.
They totally did. Well, okay, so for people who are longtime fans, forgive the question, but for people who don't know, like, the background on the band, because a lot of it was surprising to me, can you just give, like, a brief rundown of, for, you know, how did Buffalo Springfield and the Byrds and the Hollies, like you said, come together into CSN, just as the high level, like, what happened there?
You know, I think the short word, the brief word for it is desperation, you know, or something in some way. But yes, they were what was known at the time as a supergroup, which is in the subtitle of my book. And of course, when the book came out, there were a few people who were like, "What's a supergroup again?" Yeah. I realized that's such an old school, kind of rock term.
Yeah.
There aren't too many of those anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, you have Boy Genius right now with Phoebe Bridgers and Lucy Dacus and Julian Baker, who are,
it's great.
When they become together as Boy Genius, people call them a supergroup. And I guess that's as close as we got. In fact, funny, that Boy Genius album has them recreating the CSN album cover on the cover for people. They're sitting on a couch.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Just, I forgot about that.
That's a complete nod.
That's great.
But anyway, yeah, each of these guys, Stills and Neil Young, Neil being Canadian, Stills being from the South and also raised a little bit in Central America, meet in Los Angeles in the mid-60s. Well, actually, they met in New York and or before that for a little bit in Canada, but, you know, they really joined forces in L.A. to form Buffalo Springfield, best known for what it's worth at this point, a song that has been on many a soundtrack and so forth.
Yeah.
One of their first shows is, maybe their first, actually, was opening for the Byrds, who at that point were the preeminent L.A. folk rock band, which included David Crosby, best known for, they had all these hits, Mr. Tambourine Man, Turn, 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 etc., but also did all sorts of more experimental and electric folk rock and made some great records themselves. Around the same time, Graham Nash was a member of, he was over in London, in a group called The Hollies, who were one of the biggest pop groups of that time and had many crossover hits here, Bus Stop, and many other top 40 American hits. And basically, by 1968, the Buffalo Springfield were falling apart, in part because of, you know, some tension between Stills and Young. David Crosby had been fired from the Byrds, and Graham Nash was increasingly unhappy with the Hollies, wanting to break out of that sort of pop mold that they had, and, you know, he would bring them songs like Marrakesh Express, and they'd say, what is this? So Stills and Crosby are the first ones to kind of get together. They're basically, I said, desperation. They don't know, their bands have either fallen apart or they've been kicked out of bands. They're looking for work. They know each other. They start just jamming around and playing, thinking, oh, maybe we should form a band. Their mutual friend, Cass Elliott of the Mamas and the Papas, who was a big mover and shaker in the L.A. music scene, just, you know, realizes they really need another voice, and they realize, too, she knows Graham Nash. She hooks them all up. Where they first sing together is still a question of argument in the band. Some of them say they all sang together. There's a trio the first time at Joni Mitchell's house. Some people say it was Mama Cass's house. But whatever it is, you have these three guys who are basically at loose ends and coming out of bands that have fallen apart, and they really want to do something new and fresh, and they find each other, and they decide, let's give it a go. And tellingly, they don't give themselves a band name. You know, they call themselves Crosby, Stills, and Nash, just to remind people that, you know, there are three individuals in the band, and, you know, if one of them leaves, there wouldn't be a band anymore. Like, you know, I think Crosby was probably still feeling a little burned by the fact that the Byrds kicked him out, and they kept on going as the Byrds.
Yeah.
You know, if you were Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and one of them left, it wouldn't be that name anymore.
Right.
So that's basically the backstory. It's like three guys who had this whole history, each had a history, musical history, and was at wit's end, and they find each other in that sort of magical Laurel Canyon scene of the late 60s.
Well, you know, it's interesting the way you put it, was they were all came from bands that were falling apart, and then they joined a band that constantly seemed to be falling apart. It was so a little bit unsurprising when you look at it like that. But it's true.
And they were very upfront about it, you know, and said, look, we're using our names because we're not going to be a traditional band. You know, we'll maybe make records together. Maybe we will make some separate records, our own records. It's going to be like Free Love, the Free Love version of music. We're going to play with whoever we want. We're going to break the rules. That was a big thing in the late 60s. You know, you had the start of the solo album, and, you know, there were a lot of groups who were trying to bust out of that, the confinement of a quote-unquote rock band. And CSN, and then soon to be CSNY, were at the forefront of that. And they said, "Look, we're going to do things our way." The problem was the public loved them as a group, and they were even bigger than they thought they would be. And so they went on to, they stuck with their plan, but the public wasn't always down with the plan. The public was like, "Well, okay, if you guys want to make your own records, okay, but we really want the group.
Right.
So it was a blessing and a curse in a way.
That's funny because, you know, you talked about in the book, like the band agreed, I said the band, like the individuals agreed, like, this was an experiment. Let's do this. And we're going to make our own music on the side. But that's funny because, by popular demand, they just kept being pushed back together. Because people loved it so much, but I think that the release of their debut, I was surprised by the level of it. Just felt like buzz, even the way you were describing it. Like, what was it, Bill Graham or who was it that played the debut album at a concert? Like, while people were there in the hall, and people were freaking out. Like, people just loved it immediately. Is that how you saw
it? It was at a Who concert at the Fillmore East here in New York, and a friend of mine was there actually.
Oh.
And Bill Graham, who was an early supporter of CSN, played, I believe it was just Sweet Judy Blue Eyes.
Oh, that was that.
He
okay.
said, I've just got an advanced copy of this record. I want you to hear it. And he played that song, which is, 7 minutes or so. So it's quite an epic. But and the audience went sort of nuts, And that's it's almost like an early version of a viral stream or something now. Yeah. But, it was an unusual thing, I'm pretty sure, to happen back then. If someone say, to a concert hall full of people, hey, I'm going to play you this advanced music. It's not even out yet, but I want you to hear it.
Yeah.
So yes, that was absolutely right. That was a really strong indication of the enormous buzz that was going around L.A., and then it translated across the country.
Well, I couldn't believe it when I read this. That Woodstock was their second show. I mean, is that true? That's really.
That's really true.
Can you
that
believe
is really true.
That?
I got.
That's nuts.
Tour list and stuff like that. Yes. Yeah. I think it was supposed to be their third, but one of the early ones had to be rescheduled because Graham Nash had a throat issue. But yes. But I mean, in retrospect, yes, it sounds kind of crazy. But yeah, they went from Chicago to New York, at the same time, when you talk to people back then, including, say, Michael Lang, who organized Woodstock, nobody thought it would be that big. There were festivals that were starting around the country, and Monterey Pop had happened 2 years before, and so there were all these things sprouting up around the country, and, who knows, maybe you can get 50,000 people, maybe 100,000. Mm-hmm. Nobody thought it would be, almost 500,000. And so... in retrospect, it sounds like, oh my God, how could you play your second public show to that many people? But also that was part of their the power play of their manager, co-manager David Geffen, who heard about this thing, and he was determined to get them as big make them, give them as big a presence as possible, and smart, he put them on the Tom Jones show, and he got them the gig at Woodstock, and he was into I'm going to break this band big, and everyone's going to know who they are. So it was a little bit of that, and a little bit of, more people showed up than everybody thought.
We're still talking about crazy. That show. Wow.
Here we are, 52 years. It'll be 52 years this summer, and we're still talking about it.
That's wild. Well, okay, so at Woodstock, the most famous thing that people still talk about is Jimi Hendrix's performance. I'd consider myself a really big Hendrix fan, read books on him, love his whole catalog, and somehow I completely missed the fact that he and Stephen Stills jammed together. There's recordings of it on YouTube. And then Hendrix even put out the version of Woodstock that he and Stills jammed on a record that came out, I think it was 2 years ago. And can you talk about, I had no idea Stills was to the caliber of guitar player that somebody like Jimi Hendrix would be like, let's jam and let's record together. And I think they even talked about an album. I mean, that whole thing was like, what? I had no idea.
It's kind of easy to forget that Stills was at one point, considered one of the great guitar players, and he also was a real multi-instrumentalist. I mean, he played most of the instruments on the first CSN record, and he and Hendrix bonded early on and would start jamming in California, in L.A., when Hendrix was there. And a lot of times, Stills would actually play bass sometimes. Sometimes they'd go back and forth on guitar. And I think they both were... I mean, Stills was the real musician of CSNY. I mean, in the sense that he could play a lot of different instruments. He would love to, like, you know, get a bunch of players together and just play and just jam. Yeah, just like 20-minute versions with lots of solos, and not really what the other guys would sort of do. Neil could do a pretty long solo with Crazy Horse sometimes, right. but it's a little different. Like, Stills was a little bit of a looser kind of free-for-all kind of thing that he just loved to kind of immerse himself into, and he you know, those guys bonded right away, and they, you know, when Stills moved to London in early 1970 for a while, they would, you know, hang out and go out to clubs and bars together, and Hendrix played on Stills' first solo album on a song called Good Times, Bad Times, and so there was a whole, you know, I mean, Still said to me in an interview for my book Fire and Rain that he, that Hendrix was trying to find him to form a band, but that Still thinks the managers intentionally did not pass the message on to Stills because they didn't want him doing that. They wanted him to stay with CSNY.
Wow.
Yeah, and so this is when Stills was in Hawaii recuperating from a broken wrist thing, things were primitive back then. There were no cell phones, no internet. You know, it was basically landlines and answering machines, if you were lucky, I guess. But but he maintains that, you know, Hendrix wanted to form a band with him, and he was open to the idea. And then, of course, months later, Jimmy was dead.
Yeah.
But yes, they had a real connection there, and that version of Woodstock that was unearthed recently. Was actually recorded before the CSN version.
Oh, that's right.
Really interesting. Interesting. And I was still kind of working out the arrangement with Hendrix, and it was great that finally came out. And there's more in the vaults, and we haven't really heard too much of it. It's been, like you say, there are bootlegs and YouTubes, but nothing sort of official.
Yeah,
as much has come out yet.
Well, I love the way you describe it, that version was before the recorded version with the band of Woodstock, and it probably informed the final official version because he got to jam on it and kind of amp it up a little bit compared to their acoustic type stuff. But
absolutely.
Okay, so you got this great debut. This band is gelling. They sound amazing. There was a lot of questions about why would you want to mess up the chemistry there and add someone like Neil Young? Not mess up, but there was fear is what I sensed from the way that you wrote about it within different people around the band. Why did they need Neil Young? Why do you think they even considered that in the first place?
It was a lot of different factors there. I mean, one of them was they had to tour behind the first record, and they realized they needed another player on stage. Stills would alternate between lead guitar and keyboards.
Mm-hmm.
Crosby and Nash could play some guitar, and they had a rhythm section, but to fill out that sound, they really wanted someone who was another keyboard player or something. And this is because of the story gets hilarious, because, I mean, they were pretty, their egos were already getting, you know, pretty big at that point. So they were approaching obscure people like George Harrison and Eric Clapton to join the band, who were all like, well, thank you, but no. They tracked down Steve Winwood, and he said no, and so forth. There were a bunch of other names bandied around, and they were finally, you know, was getting close to the start of a tour, and they were, you know, and finally it was their head of their label, Ahmet Ertegun, who was a huge Buffalo Springfield fan and loved seeing Stills and Young play together, and he was so upset when that band broke up. He felt that was a major loss, which it was. And he, you know, he's the one who threw the idea. They're like, well, what about Neil? You know, and, you know, it's funny because we, at this point, we think, well, you know, why would Neil Young do that? He was this big rock star, and why would he join another band? But we forget that in, you know, early to mid-1969, CSN were the rock stars.
Right.
They had this huge first album. Neil was still, I mean, he made two great solo albums, and everybody knows This Is Nowhere had just come out, but those records weren't big at the time. They were not big sellers. They didn't have hit singles. And so it became a mutually beneficial situation, really, because CSN needed another player, and they knew Neil was a great songwriter and could play keyboards and guitar, so it sort of suited that end. And for Neil, it suited his end because it got his name out there.
Right.
I mean, it was very, and, you know... and they're all aware of that. I mean, you know, Crosby, is, as he said to me, you know, they knew that he was just using the group as a stepping stone. But, you know, they were like, well, how could you argue? Why would you say no despite that?
Right.
You know, and so everybody knew that there was this very delicate nitroglycerin quality to the trio, and they did, and they had, you know, but it's almost like they had no choice in some strange way but to kind of take him on. And I've asked them in each interview as well. Yeah, I still don't get it. Like, why didn't you just get some session keyboard player to be the other person in the band? And they were just like, you know, it just, we couldn't find it. And Neil was, you know, and you know, it made them instantly a super group, even more, more of a super group. And so, you know, it was. But of course, what's funny is that they didn't want to use Neil's name. At first, in the group, they still wanted to be Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and have Neil just on stage behind them. And an early indication of how Neil was very strong-willed and could call the shots, you know, he and his team were like, "No, my name has to be part of the group."
Yeah.
So, and that delayed the things for a little bit, but anyway. It eventually they agreed and they became a quartet. But it was like I say, it served everyone for at least that initial period to all come together on different levels.
Yeah, and the David Crosby quote that you were bringing up was really what stuck with me, where he mentioned, yeah, we knew that he was coming on to get popular and to get more famous, to go do his own thing. But he served our needs and we served his, and it was, we got it. We understood. And we were okay with it.
It was another extension, I think probably in their minds, of the experiment we talked about. Like, hey, look, we'll add another person.
See what
nobody normally does this.
Yeah.
You don't put out a record by three guys and suddenly you're on tour with four guys, but you know what? That's, we're going to just do what we want.
Yeah. Well, so when I'm looking at the book as a whole and their story as a whole, for me, like the thing that stuck out, the moment in the book that was the most compelling, and that I'm listening to it on Audible, and I went back a couple times listening to it, but the way you set it up, I was pulled in, and I love stories behind songs, and that's really what we talk about so much on this podcast, are the stories behind the songs. But Ohio is still shown, at least in iTunes, as their most popular song. I love that it is it's such an agitated song with a message, with all hitting on all cylinders for the things that they're known for. But I love how you set up the story about the song over what happened across 9 days between the band almost breaking up, losing a drummer, writing the song, recording the song. Can you just give an overview of that for people who don't know? I couldn't believe it.
It was an absolute encapsulation of their story in that very short period of time, because they go on tour with the four of them, and the first night is a catastrophe on many levels, and they essentially break up after that first night in Colorado, in Denver. And they have an entire tour ahead of them, and they just decide, again, we're going to break the rules. We're not happy with Stills. He's a pain in the butt. We don't want to do this anymore. Business does not work that way. as you, Ryan, as a musician yourself, sure you know this. Yeah. Managers aren't like, oh, sure, you just want to cancel a big tour of arenas?
No problem. No problem.
Basically, they go back to L.A. all together. They read the Ryan Act.
Gosh.
You can't do this.
I wish I could have heard that conversation, them being told,
Exactly. Right before this, Kent State had happened right before that first concert in Denver that fell apart. And after they break up, and as things are momentarily in turmoil, is when Neil writes Ohio. And with Crosby visiting him at the same time and witnessing this happen, like as a spontaneous thing. Neil sees an issue of Life magazine, which was the preeminent weekly photo news magazine of the time. That's where you got your news, among other places. And so he sees they have this huge spread of many pages of pictures from that horrible event. And he's inspired. He writes the song right away. They have to go down to L.A. to rehearse for this tour, to resume the tour. They all meet up again in L.A. and Stills has some studio time for his own record he's working on. And Crosby's like, they're all like, Neil's written this great song. We got to record it and put it out right away. And so even though they are all unhappy with each other and things aren't great, it's a fascinating example of how, you know, the times and current events can impact people. And they all kind of decided, you know what, this is an amazing song. This statement needs to be made. Let's just get our act together, especially this one night in the studio, and just nail it. And they did. They gathered together. They rehearsed it a little bit in a couple of takes. It was done. And it was in a record store. It was in a single in record stores about a week later, which was phenomenally fast. Especially
Gosh, that's fast. That's crazy fast.
Incredible. And so they went from in those 9 days from breaking up to reconvening and, you know, breaking up, having a pretty tough meeting with managers, and then reconvening and recording that song all in that short period of time. And that's such a distillation of then they went on tour and then they broke up after the tour again. So, and that's sort of a rinse and repeat, you know, aspect to their whole story, but encapsulates it pretty well.
Man, I feel like that song is just, it's so powerful. I mean, that's what I listened to right before that. I was like, I want to get in the mindset. And gosh, the song is just so good. And those harmonies, when they come in, they just really complement Neil's song in a way that if he had done that solo, obviously it still would have sounded awesome, but I think their sound is what made that song what it is.
And I'd recommend people to check out, my favorite version is actually the live version on their Four Way Street album, which I think has an added electricity to it. Crackling kind of sound that I think actually surpasses the studio version. And, you know, I spoke to someone who worked at the Fillmore East at the time, a guy named Alan Arkish, movie director. He did Rock and Roll High School and all these other movies. Mm-hmm. And he was like an usher at the Fillmore East at the time. And he was there when they were played that venue in the summer of 70. Wow. And he said, you know, when that song came on, I mean, you can imagine how raw the emotions were.
Oh man.
This is a month and a half, maybe 2 months after Kent State. And people are still in a state of shock. They can't believe this actually happened. The four students were shot and killed in a protest in America.
Yeah.
You know, it's just no one could get over it. And here's this song about it. And you can only, you know, imagine how powerful that was at that point.
Well, I wonder, did you hear anything about the process of Crosby seeing Neil, like, write the song on the spot? I mean, I'm just trying to picture this. They go to, like, somebody went to the grocery store, threw in a copy of Life magazine, ends up at the house, he starts writing it.
That's basically it. They were, they had a roadie named Leo Makota who had a house in the Redwoods and outside of San Francisco, and they were all, Crosby was living up there at the time, and I think Neil was either on his way up there or, you know, they were all going back and forth between San Francisco and LA at that point, all of them. And Nash ended up moving there too. But so after that whole calamitous concert in Denver and the meeting, Neil and Crosby, who were very tight at the time, not so much now, but back then they had a real bond. They were like, let's just, you know, get away from everything, and they visit their friend Leo in his house. And sure enough, somebody goes out to the grocery store, buys food, and sees that copy of Life magazine, brings it back. And, yeah, Crosby has told the story that they were just sitting there in the outside the house in the sunshine. Neil flips through this magazine and look at these pictures, and he's got a guitar there. And like, you know, I mean, it's supposedly 15 minutes Neil wrote that song. Then Crosby called Nash and was like, you can't believe this song. We got to do something with this, you know. So,
I love that part.
Quite something.
I love the specifics of it. Well, and I'm a guitar guy, so I went and learned this song, just, you know, get my head inside of it. And for guitar players who are listening, the E strings are both tuned down to D strings, or D, the note D. So the tuning's a little different. But I think especially there's the G minor chord is where he hits, which is a really weird chord in that tuning. And it's the gotta get down to, which is one of the coolest changes. But as a guitar player, like, it's a really weird chord. I wouldn't have known to go there in the tuning that he did. And so I love that. I was like, what? There's so many layers on this song.
Still grouses a little bit, as he did to me, that he could have used another verse.
Yeah, I get that. I was like,
that's the songwriter in him.
Yeah. But I thought about it, because I caught that quote, and I was like, you know what? I went listen over and over. I think that it might jumble it up. The message is in that one verse, and it hammers it in. I don't know. He's the expert, right. But I don't know. As a fan, I love it. Well, so is there anything, I'm just wondering, is there anything in the process of writing the book that came across that surprised you, that still you're surprised by in general about this group?
It would always surprise me when they would sort of come back together, I suppose, to figure out why that was happening at certain points. But I think what surprised me from time to time would be something terrible would happen, they'd break up, or something would happen, but you then have these moments when suddenly that bond would come back in sort of, funny ways, like in the early 90s, they had this terrible period, and once again, Stills is off on his own, Crosby and Nash are on their own, and then they get together, finally make another record together in 94, and Stills is there in the kitchen of the studio cooking for them, making food.
Yeah.
Things like that would be like, when Crosby was in a terrible situation, when he was busted and he was broke, and Nash bought his song publishing.
Right.
Then he had Crosby buy it back, but Nash was so worried, he's like, song publishing is major for artists. Yeah, as we're all realizing now with people like Dylan and Neil Young and Paul Simon selling their song catalogs for huge amounts of money. That's revenue. Right. And Nash was always very smart about the business of music, and he was like, he didn't want Crosby like blowing through his song royalties or selling his songs for drugs.
Yeah.
So he's like, I'm going to just buy his songs away from him and give it back to him later, so that at least, and you think that's a sign that there's something that these guys care about each other despite everything. Like, there is still that family. They're a dysfunctional family, it's like family members who get together for a Thanksgiving meal and they have a great time at first, but by the end of the night, they're starting to rub each other wrong again. And that's kind of like these guys, and that was surprising. And, there's lots of little moments like that where I thought, because you keep wondering, like, why do they put themselves through this again, other than, frankly, a living? They never made as much money or played as big halls as they did when they're together. And that's just the reality of it. But it's like, it can't just be that.
Right.
And so, on the last CSNY tour in 2006, which may well be the very last one ever, they were playing some song and Stills unleashed some great solo, and afterwards Nash remembers Neil telling Nash, like, that's why we have Steven here. Like, I could never do that.
Wow.
When he does that, he's awesome. Yeah. You know? I don't know if he used the word awesome, but that was the feeling of even that late date, like, they had some kind of a musical bond too, and they saw what they could each bring to each other's music at best.
Man, well put. Well, for people listening, I'm going to put the link to this book that I have just loved. The link will be in the show notes, and it's Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, The Wild Definitive Saga of Rock's Greatest Supergroup with David Brown. David, thank you so much for taking time to chat today. It's been a real pleasure.
Likewise, Ryan. Great questions, and great talking to you.
Thank you for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.